We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast. Soylent Green is people. I'm Brandon Shea Mutella, and I am your host today. And joining me, we've got ourselves a first-time guest. How's it going?
Not too bad. I'm super happy to be here.
Welcome, Michelle. Why don't you tell everybody who you are and tell us a little bit about your podcasting experience first, because you're new. Not only are you new to podcasting, you're kind of new to Millennium, which is going to be a really interesting discussion today.
I am very new to Millennium. In fact, I've seen all of 8 episodes to this point. So forgive me for my lack of knowledge, but I am here to learn, I guess. My podcasting experience, I am a noob at that as well. I've done a few roundtable episodes of the XCast, as well as participating in the XCast Live. But yeah, I'm a pretty much noob to podcasting as well, so I'm willing to learn about that as well.
Excellent. Well, we'll make it easy on you here. We'll have a nice, easy episode for you to talk about.
Yeah, nice, light, fun topic here.
How do you say your last name? Milbauer?
That is correct, Milbauer.
Perfect. Michelle Milbauer, welcome to The Time Is Now. So what we're going to do is, now, while this is going to be the first episode of The Time Is Now that the listeners are going to hear me on, I've actually recorded another episode that's going to be airing in a couple of weeks, and I've already answered my group initiation questions on that. So I'm going to leave that for you guys to discover later on, but we're going to ask Michelle her group initiation questions. And these are very similar to the 5 questions of X that Tony has for new guests on the XCast podcast. So, you know, while we understand that this is very limited experience for you now, maybe if you decide to come on for a later season 3 episode, we could ask those questions again and see how they may have changed. So, but first, Michelle, we'll start with the 5 questions. So when did you first discover Millennium?
I first discovered Millennium back in 96, actually. I knew of its existence. I was, however, deep into my obsession with the X-Files. So, my 1013, I hasten to say expertise, but I'm much more familiar with the X-Files. I knew of it then, but it just didn't seem like a fit for me at the time, so I never watched. Mm-hmm. And I picked up the DVD collection from Amazon at a really relatively good price recently at the encouragement of my friends over at the X-Cast. So, I picked it up, and I've only started watching recently. So, as I said, I've seen all of 8 episodes thus far.
Yeah, as I mentioned in that other one, like, season 1 was tough for me because, you know, while I was kind of interested in those kinds of things, you know, I'd been watching 7 and movies like that, you know, this show was a little too, not quite what I was looking for on a week-to-week basis, and, you know, I gave up watching Millennium after the first season and randomly caught an episode near the end of season 2, and the show is very different in feel for each of the 3 seasons. Mm. Each season has a very different feel. So it'll be interesting to have you watch along and experience this for the first time, you know, seeing these things and seeing these differences. You know, I may have been a bit too young to appreciate what season 1 was, and I'm quite looking forward to discovering it again as I'm watching along with the Time Is Now podcast.
One thing that is my initial thought on season 1 specifically, as that's all I have experience with, is that it is not necessarily a show that's suited to binging, I don't believe. I think you need to give yourself a little breathing room. This being said, after having essentially binged 8 hours worth of it. So I do look forward to watching the rest of it. I don't think that I'll be watching 8 episodes in one sitting, however.
Excellent. So of the 8 that you've seen so far, what would you say is your favorite episode so far?
It's hard to say that The Well-Worn Lock is a favorite,
yeah,
based on subject matter that we'll get into here in the next little while. I've made some notes here, and I think that Blood Relatives may be so far the closest to an X-Files episode. I'm trying to train myself not to compare the two because they are not the same show at all. At all. But it was just weird and creepy, and I found myself giving it the same attention as some of those weird, creepy early X-Files episodes where I don't know if I want to watch this, but I can't turn away either. So I think maybe thus far Blood Relatives might be my favorite. That's only out of 8, so I reserve the right to change that.
And we definitely will grant you that. Would you believe it or not that there's actually 2 Darren Morgan episodes in season 2 and they're comedic?
Shocking coming from Darren Morgan.
But I mean, like, I know, but even in this show too, like, to have comedic episodes is just like, what?
I think you need it, though. Because this is so much darker. I think that his take on these will be interesting, and I look forward to getting to those.
Okay, so this one we got to kind of skip. What's your favorite season?
So far, 1.
Oh, right on. Okay, good. Yes, we're off to a strong start. Who's your favorite character so far?
Okay, this is going to sound weird, but I'm good at sounding weird. When I was watching and the name CCH Pounder came up in the credits, I was like... Yes, irrationally happy by seeing CCH Pounder's name. So can I say Cheryl Anders, even though I know she's only in 5 episodes the entire run?
You know, CCH Pounder gives anything credibility. I think that CCH Pounder being an episode increases its rating by at least 3 stars.
I believe it. She's awesome.
Yeah, RoboCop 3 is definitely at least a 3-star movie just because CCH Pounder's in it.
That sounds legit to me. Actually, also, I want to say that the character of Catherine Black, I want to give her a shout-out, too. Now, I like the fact in the 3-ish episodes... including Well-Worn Lock, she's at least giving more to do other than being an angst point for Frank. Now, I don't know what happens to her, so we'll see. Hopefully she is not just, you know, bait and something used against Frank going forward. But for right now, the past couple episodes, I enjoy the fact that she's at least given more to do in the episodes. So I stand by CCH Pounder, but I and her character of Cheryl Anders, but I'm hoping and holding on hope that Catherine Black has more to do and is more of a focus going forward. But I'm a noob. No spoilers for a 20-year-old show, but you know.
There is a heavily focused Catherine episode in season 2 called Anamnesis, which is absolutely outstanding. It's really, really amazing.
And okay, good to know.
You know, it is up there, as they say in that other one, it's on the par with this episode. Like, Well-Worn Lock is probably my favorite, but Anamnesis is up there too, you know, and it's, and I'll talk about that a little bit, you know, but they're both really outstanding episodes. CCH Pounder, I love her, and I think she's great, and I was doing a Star Trek podcast over on Trek FM called The Edge, and we did an episode about who we wanted to see for the captain of season 2 of Star Trek Discovery, and I'm like, CCH Pounder all the way, baby, yeah.
I am not into Trek. But if I saw that CCH Pounder was going to be a captain, I might just even have to jump into that as well.
Excellent.
That may make me a convert to Star Trek.
Now, I know we have some limits on this one as well, but so far, what would you say is your favorite moment from the show?
That's hard to say as well. And folks that have listened to me at all on the X-Cast know that I'm good at nonsensical rambling. And also that my sense of humor tends to be a bit, we'll say, quirky and self-effacing and definitely self-deprecating. So forgive me if that's not your jam. But so far, my favorite moments in Millennium, because I'm a noob. I have 8 episodes in, as I've said repeatedly. Right now, my favorite moments are myself playing a game that I like to call, what episode of The X-Files have I seen this actor in? And I know that's my own mental block, and I've got to get past that, but I will find myself looking at an actor or actress and being like, I know that person. My husband's on the other sofa laughing at me. So 2 seconds later, I can be like, oh! She played the hooker that Donnie Faster killed in Irresistible, because that's the way my brain works. So right now, those are my fun moments. Where have I recognized these characters from?
I love Vancouver's actors.
That's great. The red-haired actress that was in Blood Relatives, I was like, oh, she was the stoner chick in a bunch of Darren Morgan episodes, or just weird random things like that. So far, those have been my favorite moments, but I'm training myself to not look for that or look past that and get see the episodes for what they are. So I'm working on
Excellent. I love it. Okay, well, those are, you know, limited answers, and we understand. You know, I think you'll probably change a few of your opinions as the show goes on.
Most of them. One would hope, right?
Well, why don't we just jump into our initial discussion here on the well-worn lock. So the basic description of this episode is Catherine helps a victim of incest take her father to criminal court. Now, Michelle, how would you rate this episode, and what do you think the general consensus on this episode would be?
I would rate it high. In those 8 episodes, there were a few. I took notes as I was watching the episode, just, you know, to capture my own initial thoughts on things. And a few of them there were really hard to get through for different reasons than this episode was difficult. And honestly, when I was in episode 3, 4, maybe 5 even, I thought, okay, I'm going to get through Well-Worn Lock because I've obligated myself to discussing it, and I've got to give it a chance. I was ready to walk away, thinking, okay, I'll watch this one because I've agreed to, and then I'm done. But after watching this episode, I will watch more. So I have to rate it quite high. I don't have much of a basis for comparison, so I don't feel comfortable saying this is a 10 out of 10 because I don't know what I'm comparing it to going forward. So I'm going to rate it, I think, relatively high, and I'll say 7.5, 8 maybe.
I think my favorite episode of The X-Files is Drive. So I love this episode, and I think it's a great episode, and I think it is 10 out of 10. Now, within the X-Files, I would give it a 10 out of 10 rating, but I think out of context, somebody could watch that show and possibly give it a 10 out of 10 rating. So if we withdrew this from Millennium and you put it into another show, like, do you think that this would be a 10 out of 10 show? Like, you're saying I hesitate to give it a 10 out of 10, but, like, could you say this could be a 10 out of 10 external from Millennium, just as an episode of television?
An episode of television. I don't know that it's a perfect...
Sure.
Episode. Yes, it's 44 minutes, and they have to fit their content into that with commercials and you know, broadcast television. So there's only so graphic they can get. Not that I needed anything graphic. I don't want to see what was going on. The implication. I get it. But there were things left hanging. The courtroom scene and the wife mom character. Her exclamation at the end, and it was cut off from there. You know, logically, based on the final scene with the characters, the daughters, what transpired, but there was some stuff that was left hanging there, and that may have just been edited for time. So I don't know that I could give it the perfect score of 10 out of 10. Taking it, you know, not comparing it to any other episodes of Millennium, because I haven't seen many. Yeah, I mean, it would be a very powerful piece of television. So, you know, I could adjust it up, definitely, considering that.
So IMDb gives this a rating of 7.5 out of 10, which is what you gave it, right?
Yeah.
So you're right on there. But there's only 234 votes. Now, I didn't really look into it, but I noticed on the other episode I did, Sacrament, that there's not very many votes on there. So, you know, X-Files, when they talk about on the X-Cast, they have, like, you know, a couple thousand votes.
Sure,
and
it's streaming. The X-Files is streaming. This one's not.
Yeah.
There's kind of a barrier to entry as well.
Yeah. I want to give this episode a 10 out of 10, and we'll talk about a few issues that I have with the plot. And it's one of those things where, on a first watch, this is a 10 out of 10. You know, there are some plot holes that you only start to catch upon rewatches and things that don't quite work. And so, you know, when I look at an episode like this that I love so much, I wonder, how harsh should I be on those things? Because, again, like you said, this is a television show in what, 1996, I believe this came out, right? You know, there's only so much that they can talk about on TV. There's only so much that they can show, and they do have to advance the plot in a 44 minutes. So there are, we will talk about it, there's things that Joe Bangs does in this episode that I think are ridiculous, you know, and we'll address those, and they are humongous. To me, like, they're big plot holes, but I'm like, when you're watching the episode for the first time, I don't notice those things. Like, I watched this episode for the first time in probably a decade when I got prepared for the show, and then I watched it again, you know, and I only noticed those plot holes watching it again so quickly after I saw it the first time. So, you know, upon multiple rewatches, yeah, I'd probably have to drop this down because it maybe could have used another rewrite, but if I just throw this episode in and I haven't seen it for a long time, it's just so powerful, so important, and so emotional that I think I got to give it a 10.
It's riveting. I found myself with some of the episodes prior to this one cracking wise, because that's, you know, as I said, my sense of humor. And, you know, pointing out, oh, I've seen that actor before, I've seen that actress before. And that is the case in this episode as well. But that was not something that I... one, felt compelled to even point out. Not that my husband, who was in the room with me, would have cared one way or the other. Like, yeah, okay, sure it is. Whatever you say. So yeah, I mean, it was a riveting, compelling, horrifying episode to watch. Moving, profound, heavy. There's a lot of adjectives that can be used to describe it, most definitely.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit. I just want to mention the main actor, the main guest actor, and this is Paul Dooley. Are you from Canada or the U.S.?
I'm from the U.S.
The U.S. Okay, so Paul Dooley, I know him primarily from two other roles. I'm a huge Star Trek fan, so he played an Auburn Tane on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, who's this wonderful Cardassian character. And then in Canada here, have you heard of Bob and Doug McKenzie, the
Hosers? Oh, of course, yes.
So they had a movie called Strange Brew, which is basically Hamlet in a beer factory, right? And he's the uncle from Strange Brew. So those are the roles that I primarily know him from. What do you think of Paul Dooley as an actor?
He was just one of those ones that I have seen Strange Brew. It's been 150 years. I'm originally from Pittsburgh, so I'm a Yinzer. I'm also a hockey fan, so go Pens. And so, yeah, I'm familiar with the characters and the Hosers, and yeah. So I recognized him. He was one of those ones where it was also, oh, I've seen him before. There tends to be a lot of character actors I've seen, not necessarily in this episode specifically, but in the show so far as a whole. But yeah, he's somebody I've recognized. As I said, not really a Star Trek fan, but
we'll recognize him.
We'll work on it.
Excellent. Okay, well, we're going to move into our deep discussion on the episode here. And at this time, we do want to give the listeners, we want to give a trigger warning here. I mean, if you're not familiar with the episode, it deals with, I mean, we did mention already, it deals with incest, it deals with sexual abuse, it deals with sexual assault. And it's a very powerful episode. And we're going to talk about a lot of these things. And if we pull any punches on this discussion here, it's going to be doing a disservice to the episode and the mention that and the message that is intended with this episode. You know, talking about this now in the wake of the Me Too movement is very important. And this is a very powerful episode, and it's still a very important episode. And I found myself, when I was watching it, I haven't seen it since I've had kids. And now that I have kids, like, this impacts on a whole nother level for me, you know, And I think it's important that we do this episode justice. So we need to give you that trigger warning that we are going to be talking about these kind of topics. And so that this may affect people on a level that I couldn't even possibly understand.
Thankfully, I'm not in a position to have experienced any of this kind of trauma. In this, we're in, as you said, the era of the Me Too movement. And I think as a woman, unfortunately, most of us have experienced some, hopefully most of us, minor degree of catcalling and degradation of that level. But hopefully the overwhelming majority of us have never experienced anything to this degree. The first thing that I did after the episode ended was talk to my friend Google and do a search for hotlines. So I would like to say that there is a crisis text line where if you know somebody that's going through anything, they can text in the United States the word home to the number 741741, and a licensed counselor, somebody is there that's trained, not just some schmuck on the other end of a smartphone, will respond. It is free. There is a line in Canada. You also text HOME to 686-868. And the same thing, that is the Canada line. In the U.S., this can be found at crisistextline.org or crisistextline.ca for those in Canada. I apologize, I wasn't able to find anything for those in the UK or the EU. I did, however, find a website that is worldhelplines.org, and it lists numerous resources for those in the US, the UK, Canada, Europe, Australia, Asia. There's numbers and places where people can seek help all over the world. So if anyone is experiencing anything that they need to talk about, that they need support with, that they need help with, please reach out and get help. It's there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's great that you did that.
So now my friend Google is probably concerned about my well-being, but not to make light of a very heavy topic. But as I said, please get help, because going online and seeing just endless stories about people that feel suicide is their only way out of the trouble that they're experiencing is heartbreaking. So please, anyone, there's help out there. And that's why I know this is jumping to the very end, but when Catherine says to the victim, the quote is, "You are not a victim, you're a survivor." And that was powerful to me. So yes. Yeah, that's the one thing in this episode that really stood out, that you can be not seen as a victim, but as a survivor. So that's a heavy place to start, but I think it's important.
Well, let's start on the episode here. So we open on a scene of a family watching a movie. The father says it's everyone's bedtime, but the older sister wants to get ice cream. You can tell by the way she's acting that she's trying to stall. You can sense that there's something not going on. Something's not right here, right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And when she's getting the ice cream, we see her agitated, and then we see a flash of images in her mind. She finds her sister sitting in daddy's lap when she brings the ice cream out, and she sends her to bed. The dad finds out that the older sister is wearing her clothes under her PJs, and we cut to the older sister walking barefoot on a busy street, repeating, "Gotta stay on the line."
When they first see this family scene, and mom goes to bed, and the daughters are left sitting there with dad, it was unsettling. It was like, I don't quite yet know what's going on here, but something isn't right. That was my first impression on watching it. Like, something's uncomfortable here.
I think they did a very good job of like getting right off the bat that there's something crazy going on here. There's something not right going on. We open up on the quote. Now, let me ask you this. As a new viewer of the Millennium, what do you think of the quotes?
That was, well, I guess to backtrack a little bit, the one thing that I noticed in the title sequence during the theme, which is very Mark Snow, by the way, not as techno-y, I guess, as the X-Files theme, but very Mark Snow-ish, the flashes of words. And being an X-Files fan and being used to, at the end of the credits there, the flash of the tagline, which was, you know, trust no one, the truth is out there. They changed them up periodically in the original run, more often in the revivals. But I've noticed that the words that always pop up are wait, worry, and who cares. Do those ever change?
I don't think wait and worry do, but who cares does.
Okay. The other question I had on that was why who cares?
I think it was the emphasis on Frank Black is the person who cares, right? Like, so we've got this opening theme song that is expressing these images of, you know, distress and loneliness and fear and isolation. We've got this girl walking, like, you know, on almost on the edge of a building, you know, people entering into homes, you know, so we've got all these like dark imagery going on. And, you know, I think the initial impression of the show and my interpretation of it is that it was supposed to be a show about serial killers. You know, like that was what I thought. That's my impression of what season one is. Even after all these years, that's what season one is to me, is a show about serial killers. So what are kind of things? You got to wait for answers. You got to worry. You're worrying about your loved ones. You're worrying about justice. You're waiting for justice. And, you know, dealing with the police, you know, there's this sense of, you know, why they don't seem to care because they deal with these things all the time.
Your
it's just another
not a
case.
Person.
Yeah, evidence and not a person, so who cares? And so my impression of this, and then again with the emphasis of the Yellow House, is that Frank Black is the person who cares.
Okay, because at first it was rather curious in that, okay, are you implying a sense of apathy? Like, eh, who cares? So that was one question I had on the show in general. Otherwise, regarding the quotes at the end... At first, I don't think I quite noticed them, but as we got farther through into the episodes, they stood out more. And this one was Robert Louis Stevenson quote stating, "The cruelest lies are often told in silence," which is profound considering what the episode ended up being.
Yeah, because, you know, people, like, the lie is that, you know, I hate to say this here, but my impression on this, and we might be spoiling stuff for the end. I mean, like, hopefully you've seen the episode we're talking about this, is the biggest lie in this is Mrs. Bangs, in my opinion. And I mean, like, watching this episode, and it's not that she condoned it, because I don't believe she did, but she didn't address it. And, you know, even at the end, she's, like, ignoring it.
Complicit, you know, in her silence.
Yeah, complicit in her silence. And so, you know, I think about that when I see that quote. Now, I looked up the quote on a website called enotes.com, and it said, for context, it said, "In The Truth of Intercourse, Stevenson begins by saying that despite the currency of a proverb to the opposite effect, it is easier to tell a lie than to tell the truth, inasmuch as truth is so hard to ascertain. He notes that the habitual liar may be a very honest fellow and live truly with his wife and friends, while another man who never told a formal falsehood in his life may yet be himself one lie heart and face from top to bottom. Later in the essay, Stevenson tries to show that truth is something more difficult than to refrain from open lies. For example, one may avoid falsehood and yet not tell the truth. We can speak the truth or avoid it. On the one hand, a man can speak so pithily as to avoid truth. On the other, he can speak at such length as to avoid it." And then, so there's a little bit more of a quote here that I'd like to read as well. So this is the whole context of the quote. "The cruelest lies are often told in silence. A man may have sat in a room for hours and not opened his teeth and yet come out of that room a disloyal friend or a vile calumniator. And how many loves have perished because from pride or spite or diffidence or that unmanly shame which withholds a man from daring to betray emotion, a lover at the critical point of the relation has but hung his head and held his tongue. And again, a lie may be told by a truth or a truth conveyed through a lie. Truth to facts is not always truth to sentiment, and part of the truth, as often happens in answer to a question, may be the foulest calumny." Anyway, so I just wanted to read the quote and just a little more context there.
Wow.
I haven't read this work, so I'm not too familiar with myself. And I mean, I understand this to a certain degree. I'm not the best at understanding things when they're worded in such a way like this here. But, you know, I'm understanding what he's saying, and that a lie can be in many different ways. I don't have to just say water is not wet to be lying. You know, like, you can not say anything, and it's really interesting, and that's very relevant to this episode.
Yes, and unfortunately, one thing that stood out to me, as well as it, not necessarily the abuse or incest factor that this episode deals with, but just the victim blaming and making excuses or turning a blind eye because of who the perpetrator of these acts is in society. So there were some parallels there that I saw with current political figures in the United States to be ambiguous-ish about it. I wrote down that fiction mirrors, previous fiction mirrors current quote-unquote reality.
Yeah. Now, I want to bring up at this point here, so Catherine is not my favorite character in the show. I think she's odd. I mentioned this in the other episode that I talked about. Like, she's there. I don't know that she deserves to be a main character for her contributions to the series as a whole. However, the episodes that focus on her are some of my favorite in the series. You know, like, there's this one here. There's the season two episode of Anamnesis that I've mentioned. I love the episode from season three called The Sound of Snow. You know, like, there's some amazing stuff with her, and I think that she's an interesting character, and there's rich storytelling opportunities, and I'm really glad that they did have these couple of episodes that focus on her, but I think she's criminally underused in the rest of the show because they just don't know what to do with her, you know, and what to do with her in relation to what Frank's work is. So this episode does primarily focus on Catherine and her career. So we cut to the Frank's house. The phone rings, but it's actually for Catherine. She goes into work to find Connie Bangs, the older sister that we saw in the teaser, waiting for her with Connie's older brother Larry and Connie's older sister Ruth. Catherine offers to talk with Connie, and Connie's very worried about talking about the abuse because of her father's status in the community and because of how long she has been abused. She was abused for 23 years, and she's 32 years old now.
Yeah, this scene as well, you could tell there was still something strange afoot. I mean, at this point, I kind of put together that, okay, this was happening with her. Her sister's obvious discomfort with the situation led me to believe that the same thing happened to her. And at this point, I said to my husband, who was watching the episode with me, I think that I know the origins, for lack of a better term right now, of the youngest sister, which turned out to be a correct assessment. But yeah, this scene was very uncomfortable for both of the women characters in the scene, as well as something that you never really found anything more about was the brother. What was his status as far as any abuse happened? Was he aware? Did he also turn a blind eye? Was he complicit in his silence? And those questions weren't addressed in the show, which once again may have been cut due to time, or they just weren't addressed. But that was something that popped into my mind after that scene.
I think it may be more the case in that because of the time frame that it occurred in, you know, the possibility of the father sexually abusing the son may have not entered the writer's minds.
Sure.
And so, you know, again, with the time being 96, and I mean, now things are more out in the open, people talk about things like that. I think that they just had him there as somebody who didn't know anything about it.
Right.
Is my impression of it.
This must have been groundbreaking at the time. In 96, this was late 96. So I'm going to date myself so everybody can do the math and know how old I am. Ancient. I was 18. So, you know, this wasn't foreign subject matter, or, you know, I guess it was in the fact that this was not everyday conversation. And it would have been shocking because this isn't, you know, a topic anybody should frankly feel comfortable talking about. I don't remember hearing any backlash, per se, regarding this episode.
I think Millennium just may have flown under the radar. Like, the ratings, I could be wrong. I don't think the ratings for Millennium were quite there because, again, X-Files was so big and Millennium was so not the X-Files. Like, I was watching this live, right? I was watching X-Files and Millennium live. I was 15 years old when I was watching this, and this episode blew my mind as a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I didn't know about all this stuff. A lot of the subtext that's talked about in here flew by over me for sure. But I think it's just that Millennium itself was flying under the radar, that it didn't really raise any red flags because there just wasn't enough people watching it.
Right. The one thing that I did note in watching the pilot was that Fox aired the pilot, which I know we're not discussing the pilot there, but there's some imagery there that's, wow, this was October of 1996 on network television.
Which was later, it was, I believe it was a 10 o'clock night time slot, though, as well, right?
It was late. Yeah, this isn't showing when kitties are up and watching television, or shouldn't be, anyway. Make your choices, kids, but wow. And I said at the upon watching it, like, wow, Fox aired this, but they refused for years to re-air the episode Home of the X-Files, which also deals with incest. It's more of a horror movie kind of, it's an uncomfortable episode to watch, don't get me wrong. So I looked it up after the fact. The pilot of Millennium aired
right around the same time.
October 25th of 1996. Home aired exactly 2 weeks earlier on October 11th of 1996. And so that the parallels there stood out to me, like, wow, Fox Standards and Practices had a problem with Home, but we're dealing with some really heavy topics here. And I was surprised that there wasn't more of a blowback. But as you said, maybe not enough people were watching for anybody to raise a stink, which is unfortunate because there are important topics discussed here and dealt with here.
So we continue on with the story here. The DA is speaking with Catherine and says that the laws on statutory rape are 3 years past the 18th birthday, and who is going to believe that a 32-year-old woman couldn't just walk out? So this DA doesn't really seem interested in taking this case. Now, with this episode, I think it's even more interesting, and I think it's also important for the time that this DA is a woman.
It's a woman, yeah.
I think that's very important for this episode, that even in this day and age, like, you know, 20 years ago now, 22 years ago now, that a woman who would be able to at least, you know, sympathize a bit more than a man DA. I think if it was a man DA, the episode wouldn't have had the same impact.
The forethought that went into having the woman play the DA at that time was a good choice. It raised my hackles a bit to be like, oh, we're victim blaming and why we're putting the impetus on her that she should have done something sooner, not having the empathy, the compassion perhaps to side with the victim. And that was kind of a snap judgment to me, but I think it would have been far worse for it to have been a man making the same statement. I mean, ultimately the DA did go forward with the case, obviously, or it would have been a really short episode. Another note that I made down or that I took here was money over victim rights, that they were more concerned about, oh, well, they're going to sue the police department. They're going to sue the DA's office. We're going to, you know, money talks.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's still the case. Things are getting better. Things are changing, thankfully. And the other note that I made was, well, people like this guy. He's an important guy. He ran for office. this sounds familiar. So it's okay. He can get away with this and we can sweep it under the rug because people like him. He couldn't have possibly really done this.
Well, we've got this going on with Hollywood right now as well, like all these important people, right? I mean,
exactly.
You know, being in the Star Trek community, when one of the stars of Star Trek Discovery came out that Kevin Spacey assaulted him, like even still, you know, it's a year later after he came out and people still send him messages and he retweets them where they're like swearing at him and calling him terrible names and whatnot. And he retweets them because it doesn't bother him. I'm sure it does bother him, but he's
sure.
More bringing out the awareness of all the victim blaming after the fact. And,
right.
You know, oh, couldn't you wait it until, you know, House of Cards was over and like all these weird things, you know. So
it impacted my favorite show. So how dare you?
Right.
I like the fact that he's taking these negative tweets because sometimes the internet can be a great place. And I've been fortunate enough through the XCast community to be in contact and now call myself friends with a lot of great people. But a lot of people on the internet aren't great people. And it's nice that he's taking this into his own hands and kind of taking the piss out of these people. And you're going to have the audacity and be gross enough to say this kind of stuff to me, the victim, the person that was used and abused by your favorite actor on your favorite show. Here, let the rest of the internet see what kind of person you really are. And I think that's great, and that's empowering and good for him.
Bob Bletcher comes down to warn Catherine that this is going to be a difficult case due to Bangs' status within the community. Catherine and Bob visit the Bangs' house. Joe Bangs gets upset, slams the door, breaks a window in the process, and then Joe then talks with Sarah and tells her that Connie is trying to hurt Daddy. So he's trying to turn Sarah away from her sister, which, while we learn in the episode that Connie's actually the mom, I don't know if we know during the episode whether or not Sarah knows that.
Right.
Do you get the impression on whether or not Sarah knows that Connie's her mom, or does she see her as her sister?
Yeah, that's rather ambiguous. The only point at which that I kind of thought that maybe that may be known by her is the very end. That's the scene, which we'll obviously get to later. But beyond that, yeah, I didn't get the impression that she was aware.
Okay.
Now, when we're first introduced to the family, it seemed strange that there was that young of a sister. Not that Connie seemed, you know, old per se, but to be that large of an age gap and then seeing mom when mom, quote unquote, mom was going to bed, it was like, wow, there seems to be a large age disparity between these siblings. Mm-hmm. That being said, I'm almost 10 years older than my youngest brother. And nothing untoward was going on in my family, so nobody needs to get any wrong ideas there. But once again, not to make light, right? But mm-hmm. sister's supposed to be
eight, nine, yeah.
Right? So that's a big jump. And for mom, you know, biology speaking here, mom would have been awfully old to have given birth 9 years prior.
Whoa. Have you seen My Struggle 4?
Oh, that's a... you haven't heard me rail on My Struggle 4, have you? Ask Carl. We don't want to have this conversation. But, yeah, I mean, it just seemed like, okay, wow, something's different here. Not to be ageist, that's not what I'm implying. And, right. Hey, if you
they stop making babies at a certain age. I mean,
right, biologically... It becomes more difficult. We'll say that.
Yeah.
So that was something that stood out to me quickly. But I mean, there's adoption. There's other means of having a family. So that wasn't the first thing that triggered me that something was, different. There was a lot of uncomfortableness in that scene. But I mean, back to what we were discussing. Yeah, there was nothing really during the core of the episode that led me to believe that she knew that Connie wasn't her sister.
Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, I guess if we're really getting into it, she is her sister.
She's
confusing.
Both.
Right.
She's both.
Right.
So after visiting the Bangs place there, Catherine and Bob visit the DA again. And the DA says Joe Bangs has called and claimed that Bob and Catherine broke the window. She also tells them that the medical report came back claiming that Sarah is actually Connie's daughter with Joe Bangs. And I got to say, the first time I watched this episode, I was with Bob Bletcher on this one. And he's like, well, who's the father? And when they said the father, I'm like... It took me a second to process what they were saying there, too. Mm. But, I mean, like, I was 15 at the time.
Right.
I was right along there. My reaction was, like, the same second that Bob got it, I got it,
like,
you know?
Ew.
Yeah. So that was, like, you know, again, at 15 years old, that's kind of mind-blowing to have an episode like this on TV.
As it should be.
Yeah. Yes. So, Frank comes to see Catherine at work because she didn't come home the previous night. She fell asleep on her couch at work. Frank was concerned. Catherine goes to visit Connie at her sister Ruth's place. Connie isn't there. She went for a walk. And Catherine finds out that Ruth was abused as well. Now, Ruth said that she got sick and had to go to a special hospital. And when she got back, Joe didn't want her anymore. Now, I got to ask, my first thought in watching this now is that Ruth was pregnant and then she went away for an abortion. That's my thought. What do you think?
Yes, that was my thought as well. And then I questioned whether or not sick meant that she had a mental break.
Could be too, yeah.
And that she was institutionalized. And when she got back, he didn't, quote unquote, want her anymore, which is just a disgusting thought all the way around, was because of the mental break. He couldn't be certain that he could keep her silent using fear. And that now the younger sister has reached the point in age that piqued his interest.
Yeah.
To put that as delicately as I could, I can. Yeah.
Connie comes back. Her mom and Sarah dropped her off. Connie goes to her room to be alone. Joe Bangs and his lawyer are speaking with the DA. Joe claims that Connie is crazy and that Ruth was crazy too, and that it, quote unquote, runs in the women. Joe says, and now this is the quote that I'm like, wow, holy smokes. Joe says, but when lies pass for the truth, then the whole world will have gone crazy and there won't be a damn thing that matters. And I'm just like, huh.
Yeah, this was 1996.
Yeah, huh. And it's interesting that Joe is saying this in his own defense, you know, like this crazy, gross person. Like,
right, yeah. But that seems to be how things track.
Yeah.
And so, that you spin things to make them work in your favor, which is what, obviously, he was doing and what seems to be happening
today
in current events as well. Even back to the Kevin Spacey conversation, I mean, his quote-unquote apology was not an apology, and it was an attempt to spin things to work in his favor, or to put him in a more favorable light.
Right.
It backfired on him, ultimately, and thankfully, and as seems to have happened in this episode as well, his attempt to cover his own butt by spinning it, trying to spin it in his favor, and when all else fails, make yourself the victim.
Right.
Seems, unfortunately, to still be status quo, but yeah, 1996.
Yes. Catherine comes home and has a moment with Jordan. Bob Bletcher is there to talk with Catherine as well. He tells her that the DA is wanting to sweep this under the carpet, but they decide to keep pursuing it here. Joe Bangs is trying to get into Sarah's room, and we cut to Connie having a nightmare, and we find out that the reason why Connie wanted to be alone earlier is that Mrs. Bangs told her that Joe was going to be hurting Sarah and he would kill himself if this thing kept going forward. So, like, that's, like, what a, you know, manipulative thing to do to somebody, you know, like, again, pushing guilt on somebody and trying to convince somebody that it's their fault for the situation that's happening.
The other thing that I questioned in that was that it flashed from he trying to get into her room, you know, the well-worn lock, that was revealed the true meaning of that later.
Yeah.
Are we to believe that this was only Connie's dream and that nothing has happened yet, or that it was both, that something is happening and she sees it in her dream as well, her nightmare as well? That was rather ambiguous.
Yeah.
I'd like to hope that
saying.
It was just, I would like to hope that this is just a dream, a nightmare of Connie's, and that nothing's happened to her daughter, sister,
yeah.
Yet. But I wasn't quite sure. What's your take on that? Do you think that he has started abusing the younger sister yet, or this was just a dream?
My impression on the episode is that he hasn't started to abuse Sarah yet. And that this is all provoked because he's at the point where he's lost interest in Connie, and Sarah's at that age that's piquing his interest again. Right? And
right.
So that's my impression on the episode. Now, I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I get from the episode, in that she's trying to protect Sarah because she's her daughter, and prevent it from happening to her, and that it is a nightmare, right? But I'm not sure. It is not entirely clear, but
right. I'm sure it's intentionally ambiguous.
Yeah, but that's how I interpret the episode, is that he hasn't abused Sarah yet. but he will, given the opportunity here.
Obviously, yeah.
We cut to a scene. Frank and Catherine are talking. She asks Frank if she's going too far. And Frank says one of the most important lines, not just in this episode, but like in television history, where he says, "We live in a world where people won't go far enough." And I think that's so important and so true, and that we do live in a world. And then that's, again, part of the theme of the show. You know, like you asked for the credits, who cares? You know, like how many people would see something like this and just ignore it, not address it, not bring it up?
And the first thing that came to my mind after Frank made that statement was to me that when it comes to something like this, when you think you've maybe gone too far, go farther.
Yeah.
Something like this, err on the side of caution. If you think that anything like this is happening to somebody, break that lock, whatever it takes to get somebody that's in that situation some help. I mean, and that's easier said than done, because, I mean, I can't even in the depths of my imagination fathom what it must be like going through that. And for those people that are charged with or have taken on the responsibility of dealing with cases like this, how incredibly difficult it must be. And I understand, you know, legal ramifications and stuff has to be admissible in court, but if you think you've gone too far for something like this, go farther.
Yeah, push harder.
And ultimately, she does push harder.
Now we come to the plot element that on rewatches, I have a significant issue with, and I wish the episode could have had a little bit more of a rewrite here. Catherine gets a call that Joe has run off with Sarah. Now, I understand that it's necessary to drive the plot forward for this episode. You've got 44 minutes to tell this story. But again, I question the writing of the story where in the middle of this investigation, with all this heat coming down on him, all this stuff going on, all this focus on him, he's going to run off and abduct this little girl and take her to abuse her. Or, I don't know, like I question this plot point, and I do have a real big problem with this. But again, as I said, I only have a problem with it when I watch the episode again, because watching it the first time, I don't have a problem with it because it does feel like a logical progression of the story. This guy has to get caught.
The one thing that, I mean, it's a shoulda, coulda, woulda thing, and we can't go back and change it. It would have been nice, and I don't know if this series does this with any other episodes, but it would have been nice for this to have been more of the, not necessarily cliffhanger model, but a two-parter for sure. Mm. This is something that definitely could have used a little bit more. Not to say I want to see more detail, because ew. No, but in order to resolve some of these plot holes and plot issues, and to see more character development for the others, for I'm drawing a blank on her name now. You would think I didn't watch it. The older sister who had Ruth, right, who had also experienced abuse. It would have been nice to have seen, did she provide any testimony against her father? Just further development of other characters. So it would have been nice had this been given a second episode.
Well, even if they would have replaced this scene with more of that testimony, maybe. Because again, it seems like they're just like, okay, we got to have some kind of action in here.
Yeah, something's got to get him caught. Yeah.
We got to have something happen in the scene. Just a bunch of people talking about getting raped and whatnot. Oh, we got to have some action and whatnot. And it's like, well, it's just, I think that this does hurt the episode a little bit, in my opinion. And, you know, like, talking to you about this, I mean, like, you, and you're saying things like, not that I want to see more, but I want to see more.
Right,
and it's like,
yeah.
That's the thing that I have trouble with, even on the Trek FM network, is there's a couple of episodes for a couple of the Star Trek series that people don't want to talk about because they are uncomfortable to watch. And in my opinion, those are the episodes that need to be addressed and spoken about more. This is not a fun episode to watch, but it's powerful and it's important, and as difficult as it is to address these issues and talk about them, they need to be spoken about and they need to be addressed head on. You know, and I wish that people would talk about the harder episodes to talk about in their shows. I wish they would talk about them more.
And they did a good job, too, of not falling into that trope, I guess, of the, you know, very special episode of whatever sitcom in the 80s.
Yeah.
Once again, I'm dating myself. Where, you know, everything, then you get to the end and it's all wrapped up in a pretty bow. And I appreciate that they didn't do that, you know, that it wasn't made, that everything is now sunshine and roses at the end. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely that. Yes, we have to wrap this up. There has to be a jump, something, there has to be an impetus for this guy. He has to do something in order for them to be able to further their story. He's got to get caught. We've got to get to the prosecution, the trial, the everything that happens after. It did feel abrupt.
So we continue on with this after we find out that Joe's run off with Sarah. They go to the Bang's house. Bob mentions that for a woman whose daughter is missing, Mrs. Bang doesn't seem too upset. And Mrs. Bang says everything seems to have been okay for the past 35 years, you know, thus basically blaming everything on Connie with that one statement, you know, because Connie's,
yes,
you know, 32 years old, right? So Frank goes into Sarah's room and has his vision. He finds a picture and deduces that Joe has taken Sarah to a cabin that they used to rent every Christmas. And we have this because we can't have a Millennium episode without Frank Black doing his thing. And again, I don't think that this is necessary, and I don't think Frank was necessary to advance this plot. But again, he's the star of the show, so.
The one thing that stood out to me several times when we see Mrs. Banks is my first thought they were also going to throw in the trope of the woman scorned, and that at some point she was going to snap, and like we've seen on any other number of melodramas where she was going to be the one to exact vengeance. And she just seemed so cold and so detached.
The woman that played her was amazing.
Oh, most definitely. Yes. No. This isn't a reflection on the actress, who was another one that was a star in my game of where I've seen her before. But she did a phenomenal performance. But I, speaking as the character, she was cold and so distant and closed off, which I'm sure was due to the abuse that she's clearly suffered as well. But again, complicit in her silence. So she was not, I mean, once again, victim blaming the daughter, to deflect on her own guilt for not having stopped it.
Yeah.
Previously, perhaps, because, I mean, she knows that it's not her daughter. She has to have known, she knows that it happened to one daughter. I would have to think that she knows that it happened to the other daughter as well. So this did not portray her in any favorable light. But, I mean, it's that cycle of abuse. And she's probably terrified and scarred and has been abused herself, clearly. And I don't want to use the word brainwashed because I don't believe that's the correct term. But,
Okay. Let's talk about this, because I don't get the impression that Joe Bangs is the kind of person who would physically abuse his wife. Do you get that impression from this?
No, I don't. But I mean, there's more. It's more mental abuse. Clearly, physical or clearly sexual abuse is happening. But I mean, there's something that's keeping her silent.
Yeah.
What is it? The terror that he's going to do something to the girls. There's something psychologically happening with her to keep her silent.
Right.
Because once he is in jail and, you know, presumably he's on trial.
Yeah.
So he's been caught. What is continuing to keep her silent? There's something that happened clearly profound with her that keeps her from also acknowledging and reporting on what's happened to her and her daughters. So what's the psychology there? I mean, I'm in no way, you know, the appropriate person to make that diagnosis, obviously, but you know, I'm just a TV fan.
Right,
but there's clearly more happening there than I know, but I can see that there's something else. There's something keeping her silent. What happened to her? Is she complicit in that she's just not saying anything? Was she in on it? I don't get the impression that she was in on it, but
right.
There's something more
either.
Behind there's something more with her character that I would like to know more of.
See, the impression that I get with Mrs. Bangs is that... Okay, so this is going to sound weird, but I got to talk about it the way that I got to talk about it here. So this is not like she sat down and she's talking with Joe Bangs and they're like, okay, I know what you're doing. You're having sex with our daughters. Okay, like she knows what's going on, but it's something that's never been addressed between the two of them. And her ability to distance herself from the situation is that lock on the door. So Joe Bangs goes in the room, he locks the door, she's able to dismiss herself from the situation. She's available to distance herself from the situation and therefore not acknowledge it. But why does she not acknowledge it? Why does she let it continue? And why does she not say anything? And we'll get to it in a little bit here when we talk about the courtroom scene, but why does she have such a drastic reaction to her daughter, to Connie and her and Connie's testimony? Now, again, I'm not trying to victim blame on this. I'm questioning what is the rationale behind it. Why is that the situation? Yes, so that's the question that I have during the episode. And that's, to me, that's great writing because I can come up with an answer in my own mind. I don't need to be told that answer.
But when he says previously that, well, Connie's crazy, her sister's crazy, it's a thing with all the women, that implies that mom is crazy as well.
Well, maybe she has brought it up to him then, and then he's, every time she's tried to address it, he's accused her of being crazy. The daughter, Ruth, went away for being quote-unquote crazy, and
if that's the way we choose to interpret that,
but maybe she then therefore doesn't want to address it and talk about it because maybe she has brought it up to him and he just keeps calling her crazy, and he's what's the term, look for gaslighting, I believe is the term for this, where he's gaslighting her into saying, you are nuts, you are crazy, just like, look at your daughter's crazy, we had to send her away, right, she got it from you, you're crazy. So maybe that's it there. And that, you know what, that even works for me for the episode.
Right. And it could also be that, you know, it's a coping mechanism on Mrs. Banks' part to, if I don't acknowledge it, if I don't say anything about it, if I turn a blind eye, if I look the other way, that if I don't acknowledge that this is happening, it's not really happening.
Right, right.
You know, in your own head. But the fact that she tells Connie that if you pursue saying anything, that he's going to hurt your sister and he's going to kill himself, she is enabling behavior and encouraging the silence of Connie. Like, don't say anything. You're going to cause problems and he's going to hurt somebody else and he's going to kill himself.
Right.
So there's some complicity. You know, she's in on it, at least as far as that goes. But once again, that may be a coping mechanism where if we don't rock the boat, nothing else will happen. Everything will be fine.
And this goes back to that quote right at the beginning of the episode.
Right.
After Frank Black realizes that they've gone to this cabin, they search the cabin. It's empty, but they find fresh food in the fridge. Frank finds fresh tire tracks outside, and Joe Bangs is inside his vehicle hidden under some tree branches. Joe Bangs tries to escape, but he crashes into Catherine, who's driving Frank's Jeep. We cut to the courthouse. Joe Bangs is being indicted 5 months later. The DA doesn't have confidence that Connie could give good testimony, so they're offering Joe a plea deal that would reduce his sentence to 8 years with parole in 3. And in the courtroom, Connie is ready to take the stand, but Joe Bangs' lawyer wants Joe to take the stand again. Joe then says that he suspected something for 30 years and then claims that Connie was the product of a union between Mrs. Bangs and another man, and therefore not his daughter, and Mrs. Bangs confirmed it. Now, when I'm watching this episode, my interpretation of this scene is it's a lie. He's lying on the stand, right? However, it's a defense tactic so that the incest charge can be thrown out the window, right? If it's not his daughter, then it's not incest. But I also interpret this as a lie. Now, however, my interpretation of that is like, that is an easily disprovable lie.
Exactly.
So I don't know if it's a lie. So I want to know what your impression of that scene is. What do you think of
that? Yeah. Prior to that, when I want to go back to the attempt at the plea deal first.
Yes, okay, sorry.
No problem. I'm bouncing around a bit here. but I noted 8 years with an eligibility for parole in 3.
Yeah.
Now, he opted to not take that deal because he still thinks that he can walk. Now, I didn't research to see if that is something that ever truly would have happened, that it could be that light. It seems plausible.
Yeah.
It seems realistic. The thought of somebody inflicting three lifetimes worth, because there are, four, if you include Mrs. Banks, four lifetimes of damage, and you get to walk in 3 years is gross. This isn't the podcast for that discussion. The justice system is what it is. That was the first thing that stood out to me. Like, 3 years after inflicting that much damage on people. Yuck. As far as him on the stand and making that statement.
But, well, go to that for a second there. I don't believe that that's the sentence. So in my headcanon, Joe Bangs has gone to jail at the end of this episode. We'll get to that scene in a second. And it's not going to be 8 years and three at that time.
I agree. I just that their plea deal would have been.
Yes.
You plead guilty. Instead of getting life, I don't know. I mean, taking the death penalty off the table. I don't know if that would have been an option. That's neither here nor there.
I doubt it.
I doubt it as well. But whatever his sentence would have been, it would have been longer than 8 years.
Right, okay.
So we're going to say that we'll take a plea. You plead guilty. We'll reduce your sentence to 8 years instead of whatever it would have been. And you would be eligible for parole in three. Ultimately, how the episode ends, I don't believe that that's what happens. Yeah. He didn't take the plea.
Right.
He didn't take the plea. He thought he was going to be able to walk. You know, he's free and clear that he would be found not guilty is what his thought process was. But just the thought that they would offer somebody, we think you did this, you're a creeper, you're gross, but we don't know that we can convince the jury of it, so we're going to offer this up to you. And it's a gamble, and that by default, that's what a plea bargain is, and hoping that the other person accepts. But just the thought that somebody could do this, plead guilty, get the deal, and be walking in 3 years is gross to me. That's what I got from that. Not that I think that that's what his sentence ultimately was after the trial, but that was an option that was on the table. And that's something that I'm sure has happened.
I'm sure it has.
Yeah, every day. Mm-hmm. And that's just skeevy to me. But when he gets on the stand and he makes this statement, like you said, I was like, but why would you perjure yourself?
Yeah.
Because this is 1996, not 1976.
Yeah.
So, you know, science is not what it is now.
They've already proven in the episode that
exactly.
Sarah is his daughter with Connie. They've already proven that
right.
DNA or whatever it is they
yes.
tested that, right?
Because they're saying that the youngest is Connie's daughter and daddy is Mr. Bangs. So did they state, however, I don't know that they ran Connie's DNA. They ran the younger sister's daughter's DNA.
They took the DNA testing and they confirmed that Sarah is a union between Connie and Mr. Bangs. They could easily
right.
then determine whether or not Connie is a union between Mr. Bangs
yes.
and Mrs. Bangs.
Right? Yes. So, yes, definitely.
So, like,
it can be proven that you're lying. So why make the lie?
So that makes me question that line. What if he's not lying? It doesn't make the situation any less gross.
Right. But I think what the goal there was
is to discredit Connie.
It's to discredit Connie if they allow it in evidence, because they know that it's going to take time for them to run the DNA to prove this or not. And ultimately, they scratched it from the record, but the jury's in the room.
Yes. And that's
so
the defense.
You can
tactic.
Say, exactly, you can say, oh, disregard that. You can't unhear what you've heard.
Yeah.
So that, they're people. That's going to weigh in there. So even though they didn't accept this statement into evidence, it was said. And I think that the point was to have that in the jury's mind. Now, this is a TV show, and knowing, you know, how this is going to end up, because it's a script, I don't know it was kind of a shock value thing, like, oh, and then after that bomb is dropped, did it cut to commercial? Was it sort of a mini cliffhanger?
No, it didn't.
When it originally aired? It did not? Okay, that, well, that's good, because that would have felt very manipulative. But yeah, I think it was a jury tactic, knowing that this is going to get thrown out. They're not going to accept this into evidence this late in the process. But, okay, yeah, no, you can't use that against him. Okay, but realistically, this is in people's minds now. Oh, well, he wasn't really his kid, so it can't really be incest. It's gross, but it's not that gross.
Yeah, because I'm guessing that I don't know. I didn't look into this. I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah.
I don't know what the what the sentence would be for statutory rape versus incest. I don't know if there's a differentiation. I can't speak on that. I don't know. So I question that because they've already proven DNA in this episode. So anywho. Connie takes the stand, and the DA says to her, "Tell us how your father made it impossible for you to take control of your life." And that is an important sentence in this episode, and that is an important thing that people need to understand with, you know, people who have been abused and people who have been put in situations like this, and how weak and out of control you feel in a situation like this, and how manipulative,
how helpless.
I mean, we've seen how manipulative Joe Bangs is throughout this episode already. The way he's trying to turn Sarah against Connie earlier on, you know, clearly some type of manipulation has happened with Mrs. Bangs. He's a manipulative person, and you know, when you constantly berate and belittle somebody, you know, it makes them question their value. It makes them question their own opinions, their own status, their own.
They just question their own ability to even be able to do anything.
Yeah. But watching this again, so they ask Connie about this. Connie breaks down. She can't speak. Catherine goes up to stand up with her and support her. And Catherine tells her at this time she's not a victim. She's a survivor. And Connie starts to talk about what happened. And, you know, when I watched this episode again, and even just like a day or two after I watched it, thinking about it again, like, I broke down in tears during this scene because, you know, now I'm a father of three daughters. And, you know, the interactions that I have with my daughters and the love that they have for me and how they look up to their fathers and their mothers and how much control a father can have over their children's lives. You know, they look at me, and children can believe anything that you tell them. You know, like, fathers are so important for kids. And to see this, and to know that this kind of thing goes on in the world, where somebody could take that trust and that love.
And that innocence.
And that innocence. And warp it. And abuse it. Is gross and it's crazy. And this episode is so important and people need to watch this because this kind of thing happens in our world.
Choosing to not acknowledge it doesn't make it not there.
Right. And I think that this episode is essential viewing for television in general. And as the problems that I have with the writing, like I said, it doesn't take away from the message of this and how important this is and how hard it is for people to stand up and talk about it. These are not easy things to talk about, and that's why we need to talk about them. Because this kind of thing goes on, and we live in a world where people attack people when they bring these things up, and they blame them. Like, it's their fault. Like, I look at my daughters, and I'm like, without them being my daughters, if somebody did this to my daughters, they don't ask for this.
No.
No one would ask for this. That just to see that kind of trust broken, because I know how important I am to my kids. I know how important I am to my daughters, and I know how important that relationship that I have with my daughters is, you know, and I take it. It's my duty to show my daughters what a man is supposed to be like. And I know that I'm not a perfect father, and I know that I'm not a perfect husband.
It's not about being perfect. You know, it's about doing the best you can and not a, nobody's perfect. It's being a parent is an incredibly difficult job. I can't even imagine how many ways inadvertently every day I am damaging my kids. but you do the best you can. And when you see this kind of thing, yes, it needs to be discussed. It needs to be put out there in the open that this is happening to children every day. It's horrifying.
But yeah, and, not just children. Like,
well,
like
yeah, to women, to adults, to be anybody that's suffering any kind of abuse of any type.
Sexual,
men,
physical,
women, any
mental,
any. That's why, you know, most definitely, as I said before, there's resources out there, and it's hard and it's scary, but reach out for that help. Even if it's just a friend online, something, to be able to reach out and talk to somebody. It should be your parent or your parent figure, whether it be a mother, a father, an aunt, an uncle, whoever is doing something to somebody else. There needs to be some level of trust somewhere that these people can go to. And it's unfathomable to me what this must be like. Thankfully, I grew up in a family where we joke that we're dysfunctional. We most definitely are not. Nobody's got, you know, Beaver Cleaver's family. Here, I'm aging myself again. I know who that is. But to be able to have the conversation, and even, you know, this was 22 years ago, that these subjects are still swept under the rug, or, ooh, no, we can't talk about that, is doing any survivor, I don't want to say victim anymore, survivor of this type of thing, a huge disservice. Yes, the subject matter of this was profoundly disturbing, which is why I said I don't want to call this a favorite episode, because favorite implies likes. And I don't like anything that happened in this episode, with the exception of it opening this conversation and hoping that other people will have this conversation and acknowledge that this happens. I have a 9-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. Or soon to be 9-year-old daughter, you know, 8 and almost 9. I also have a 12-year-old son, and not that I want them to sit down and watch this episode yet, because that's disturbing for them, but for parents to have the conversations, especially now in the age of the internet and social media and people having access to all sorts of other people at much younger ages than I did, that you did. I mean, I've already aged myself. I'm 40. I grew up in the middle of a cornfield in western Pennsylvania, where the worst thing that would happen to you is you'd be running through the cornfield and look down and have a spider on the middle of your shirt. You know, it was Mayberry, essentially, and bad things happened, but we were sheltered from them. If you didn't hear about it on the 6 o'clock local evening news, maybe on the NBC News or CBS or whatever, you know, nightly news was on at the time, you would hear about things. But for the most part, unless it happened in your little corner of the world, you didn't hear about it. And you didn't have access to people. So unless you had some creeper next door, you were relatively sheltered in your belief that everything was safe. But kids now, I mean, my kids love being on YouTube, and neither of them have a social media account yet. They're not old enough by my terms or by the terms of use of those services. So they're not on there yet, but they need to be educated and not scared. Yeah, you need to go out and do things. Go out and play. Go out and get dirty. But be mindful and be aware that this stuff is out there. And if something is happening, or you see something happening to someone else, or something is happening to you, you need to be able to have that conversation. Tell me. Tell your dad. Tell your principal. Tell your teacher. Tell the music teacher. Tell the librarian. Tell somebody that you're comfortable with. Because you have access to more. And if somebody's doing something on the internet, somebody's showing you pictures of something, so, you know, not to go back to the very special episodes of things that happened in the 80s, but I mean, as cheesy as those things look in retrospect, they were there to teach a lesson. I just think the lesson now needs to be more sophisticated, because it's not necessarily somebody that's at the candy shop down the street.
Right.
And I think, as you said, episodes of television like this are profound, more so for the adults in the scenarios as opposed to the kids. As I said, I don't want my kids watching this yet. I don't want them to have nightmares, but it refreshed in me the awareness and the knowledge to have the conversation. It opened that in my brain, like knowing that, yes, you know, stranger danger and those kind of things, whatever term you want to give that, to open the dialogue with your kids. You are the parent, but there has to be the level of trust there too. You can't, you know, fire and brimstone and you do what I say because I am the parent. There has to be that conversation there. And especially when the kids are old enough to be able to understand that there are people out there that mean to do them harm. And just because it's somebody that shouldn't mean to do them harm, if it's something that's making you uncomfortable, especially if it's a loved one, as was in this case for the episode, that they have somebody that they feel comfortable with saying, okay, this isn't the way that I need to feel love from whomever. It was one of those things. The beginning, earlier in the episode, they said that, and I think in the courtroom scene, it was said that he said that I was his favorite, and this was his special way of showing it.
Yeah.
That gets to a level of that mental break in that person, that that's their way of expressing love. What happens? And it would be horrifying yet fascinating to read on that psychology to find out. And I don't know if they even know, but what wires get crossed in someone's brain to make that be their way of showing quote unquote love.
I think it's just more of a lie. You know,
yeah, but there's obviously some mental break there somewhere. Yes, it's a lie, but I mean, once again, I don't want to be crude because this is a very serious and emotional topic. But what happens in someone's psychosis that this is what gets them off? As I said, I don't want to be crude. I don't want to be vulgar. And I most definitely do not want to make light of it. But
these are hard topics to talk about. And they make you question. And this episode makes you think about these things.
Yes.
You know?
Like, what psychosis is at work here? What pathology there is to make this his acceptable way of release, of expressing love? Is it that? Is it expressing rage? Like, what is his deal? And that's not something that this episode could take on, even if that was the premise of half the series. And that's not the show's job. The show's job is to, I think, do what it has done. And in my case, 22 years after the fact, but it's still very relevant, is open that line of thought and get you thinking, like, what really is happening here? And what goes wrong with somebody that this is how they act out? And once again, then on the victim side of it, building that empathy and trying to contemplate ways of, yes, preventing this from happening to people, but also letting people know that if it is happening, they need to find some way of letting somebody know and building that trust with somebody, that you have somebody that may not be part of your family unit, because clearly this family unit was problematic at best, but to be able to share it with someone and to say, if you don't feel that you can share something with me, that there needs to be somebody that you can share it with. As far as my son, as well as my daughter, I mean, it's not just a female issue.
Right.
You need, no.
Well, maybe it never was.
I don't know that it ever was. Just. That's what you always hear. but any type of assault or abuse or anything that boys as well as girls need to be able to discuss those things. Because a lot of times it's like, oh, you're just man up. That's not okay. Because number one, we need to stop the cycle of abuse in that. And back to the brother in this episode, who was largely disregarded, really. Right. He wasn't really discussed. He wasn't addressed at all.
What does he know in the situation?
What does he know? Is he Mr. Bangs part two? I mean, is this his normal? Is he doing this to his daughters?
I don't get that impression either,
but in reality, monsters beget monsters.
Yeah.
Does the brother in this situation see this as quote-unquote normal? Well, my dad did it. Mom didn't say anything. Mom didn't stop it. So I guess this is how families are. Oh my God, I hope not. It's another conversation that I guess needs to be had on another podcast.
Yeah, for sure. We need to wrap this up here because we're going long.
We can go on forever.
So much on this episode here. The last scene we get in is while Connie's during the testimony here. Mrs. Bangs has an outburst, yells to Connie, "Shut your mouth," during the trial, which is, you know, opens up so many more
additional questions
with her and why she's so hesitant for having this come out. But our final scene has Catherine giving Connie the lock. And then she throws it off this dam, which is this sense of relief, this sense of closure for her.
Freedom.
She's there with Sarah, her daughter, you know, and there's this hopeful music that's playing at the end. And, you know, like it's a sense of optimism for this character going forward, which is a great way to finish this episode. And damn it, I needed that. So,
yes. You know. Yeah, I thought the imagery there was beautiful. It was profound. Not to make light of it, like, oh, it's just butter under the bridge, let's just move on. It wasn't, and they lived happily ever after. But it was a sense of closure for them, and it was, to me anyway, the way I interpret it was a visual metaphor of, okay, this happened, but we got to keep moving on and moving forward and hopefully getting the help that is still needed. Because just because Dad is out of the picture now and this abuser is behind bars at the moment – doesn't mean that there's not still a lot of healing for them. But yeah, I thought the metaphor there was
perfect.
Was perfect. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Well, we had a lot there. We're all done with what we got to say on the episode. I'm sure we could talk more, but we're done for now. Let's jump into some listener feedback that we got from the Facebook group. Adam Silva says it was nice when Catherine was given an episode. So yes, we do get a couple of episodes with Catherine throughout the run of the show where she is the primary focus. Michael Little says, as far as the well-worn lock, it is a nice showcase for Catherine, very much within Chris Carter's wheelhouse of things that disturb or interest him. So what do you think about this for within Chris Carter's work?
Well, something that came up within Chris Carter's work is, as already established, I'm a X-Files fan. That's the breadth of my 1013 knowledge. But something that came up in one of the previous episodes as I noisily flip through the notes that I've taken for other things is a theme that seems to have started in the X-Files, but I noted in Millennium there was the statement that I believe it was Frank making that his daughter Jordan was unexpected, that they were unable to conceive, or they shouldn't have been able to conceive. And we already deftly stepped over the whole My Struggle For conversation, and any X-Cast listeners are probably cringing my rage at the end of My Struggle For. I'm still not a fan, if that wasn't evident. But even in the earlier run of the X-Files, after the abduction, after the Scully cancer arc, it was mentioned numerous times, and it was a theme numerous times of Scully's now infertility and her inability to be a mother. And that just seems to be a fixation of Chris Carter. Mm-hmm. And here it was in Millennium, before it really became a huge plot point in the X-Files. This is before William, before all of that. So I just have to wonder if that's something that he has experienced personally, you know, and I don't know. I didn't research, you know, I wasn't online stalking. I don't know if he and his wife have children, or they're not able to have children, if they chose not to have children, what their family situation is, none of our business, frankly. And if he doesn't put it out there, good on him. But it just seems to be a recurring theme. And a lot of times with, I didn't watch Harsh Realm, so I can't speak to that either. So I don't know what that series is and what the subject matter that's delved into in that series is. But it seems that infertility issues in children, and the female character's ability or inability to have children seem to be a recurring theme for Chris Carter.
Throughout his work, yeah.
So
I'm not sure about that myself. Yeah, I don't remember that line about Catherine and him not being able to have. I don't remember that.
Yeah, that was something in the pilot I made note of. I wasn't certain. That just seems to be something for him that's a recurring theme.
Jeremy Daniels says the Well-Worn Lock might have one of the most unsettling teasers in the show's history. It's kind of pushing how far it wants to go as far as a dark content. It's a solid episode, but one I would rarely want to watch again. It's unpleasant on purpose, but that doesn't make me want to rewatch it anymore. Which I agree, but it's good that we talk about them. And then
yes.
Kurt North says, The Well-Worn Lock, we need to see more of the women in all three seasons. This was a brave piece of TV and a memorable one growing up. As I look back at it on my rewatch, I did feel that the father was too in your face. Scenes involving the prosecutor, for example, were a little on the nose, that he was this well-respected, liked, and powerful man that effectively demanded to be respected. This made him feel a little two-dimensional. We could have seen us pulling back the curtain, seeing what evil he was behind the closed doors and that lock, while maintaining a likable persona elsewhere. It was done much better from a character perspective in season 3's Nostalgia. Thanks for your comments, guys. We really appreciate them. We appreciate your feedback from our group here. So
all names that I recognized, folks that I've interacted with before, and they always have such profound, thoughtful things to say. So a lot of times whenever I listen to them on podcasts or actually have the honor of talking with them, I feel deeply inept because they have such profound things to say a lot of the times. So it's a great group.
Excellent. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a whirlwind. It's a difficult episode to discuss. Thanks for putting up with my little emotional outburst there. Appreciate
it. More than okay. And as you said, it's a topic that is profoundly disturbing and needs to be spoken of. And again, not to keep wailing on it, but you know, anyone that needs help, there's resources out there, which is crisistextline.org here in the States, crisistextline.ca up in Canada, and worldhelplines.org gives resources for help across the globe. So that includes the US, Canada, UK, Europe, Australia, South America. There were a lot of resources there. So once again, I encourage anybody that may happen to be listening to this, if you need help, please, please seek it out, because things don't have to be awful.
I agree. Thank you so much for finding that information as well. Michelle, where can people find you online if they want to reach out to you and talk to you about this or any of your other appearances on the X-Cast?
I am in the X-Cast Basement group. That's a great group of people. That's on Facebook. So if you look at look for the X-Cast Basement, there's a bunch of great folks over there. I am on Twitter. My Twitter handle is mmbaker13. I am real bad at Twitter. I mostly lurk, but I'm trying really hard to get better with posting things. So mostly X-Files related, but occasional pictures of my cats and my kids and randomness. I'm good at randomness. So mmbaker13 on Twitter, and I'll try to get better at not just lurking.
Well, my name is Brandon Metella. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on the Trek FM network. I have two shows, one called Melodic Treks, which is all about Star Trek music. And you can find me on Warp 5, which is our show all about Star Trek Enterprise. You can find me on the Fandom Podcast Network with my friends Chris and Tom. And we talk about Good Evening. Well, the show is called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. And we talk about Alfred Hitchcock films. And currently going on right now, as of the recording, I'm not quite sure when this is released. My friend Zach Moore and I did a podcast series for the Talk Film Society called Halloween H4O, which is all about the Halloween films. And that's we're anticipating and gearing up for the new film that's coming out. So we're very excited about that. So those are the best places you can find me. I don't interact too much in the XCast Facebook group or the Millennium one because I spend a lot of time talking Star Trek, but as you can tell, I do truly love the X-Files and Millennium as well. And Michelle, stick with it. There's a couple of great episodes coming up. Another really great one coming up in just two episodes is called The Wild and the Innocent. It's really, really good. And I remember, you know, again, a lot of these episodes, they deal with sex and killing and death and whatnot. But, I mean, I remember another one that I really enjoyed was called Loin Like a Hunting Flame. And I believe that's two episodes after that. But season two, the tone really does change. And, I mean, like I said, I stopped watching after season one because I'm like, I can't handle this. And then when I found out how different season two was, I regretted quitting watching the show because season two is so different. And then season three is even more different after that. So I definitely recommend checking it out because it's a fun to check out Chris Carter's other work.
Definitely. As I said, I was definitely considering, okay, I'll watch Well-Worn Lock. I've obligated myself to do that, but I can't. I give up. But after having watched this episode, as difficult as it was, I am invested at this point. Good. And I will finish it out. There's three seasons. I stuck with season 9 of the X-Files. So I stuck through that. I can handle three seasons of this. But thank you for having me on. Thank you for including this noob. And hopefully my nonsensical ramblings didn't discourage Tony or any other future you or any other future hosts from having to deal with me again. So thank you for having me. And hopefully there's some episodes in the future I'll be able to contribute to.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. And remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now, plus we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.